Case number 20-5367, Amity Coach versus Thames Healthcare Group, LLC. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Ms. Lewis, you may proceed for the appellant.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel, I'm Abigail Lewis on behalf of appellant Amity Coach. We are dealing with claims under the Kentucky Civil Rights Act for disability discrimination and retaliation, and claims under the Family Medical Leave Act for interference and retaliation. Both were dismissed on summary judgment and an opinion in which the district court took a lot of the disputed material facts and looked at them in the light most favorable to Thames. And as we go through today, I hope that you will see the reason that this opinion should be reversed so that it can go forward on its merits. For Coach's Kentucky Civil Rights Act disability discrimination claim, she presented sufficient evidence of a disability, looking at definitions 2 and 3, that she had a record of disability and that she was regarded as disabled. And a helpful case to guide us with this is MX Group Inc. versus City of Covington of Judge Clay and Senior Judge Batchelder. And that case involved a methadone clinic. So obviously the people going to the clinic, even though they had an impairment, they had a history of addiction, they were trying to get better. So the entire goal was that it would no longer substantially limit a major life activity. However, the fact that they were at the clinic in the first place meant that they had a history of that. And also that there is a good chance that the other side regarded them as disabled. And that is similar here because Amity Coach, ideally, when she has the medication that she needs, even though she has documented impairments, she doesn't want them to substantially limit her life activities. And when she unexpectedly lost access to that medication, and she had one isolated week in which it did substantially limit her life activities, that is where the trouble started. She does have a record of disability, and the record it shows that in 2016, no medications were working for her. They were even considering electroshock therapy. And there are also some attendance issues from early in 2016, which is outside of the 12-month look-back period, but still that show that it was substantially impacting her work.
What evidence do you have that Ames knew that her medication was not working for her condition?
Yes, Judge Bush. Are you referring to 2016 or the week in question?
I'm just asking generally what evidence you have.
Okay.
That Thames was aware that her medication did not take care of her ADHD and
mm-hmm. Well, there is a disputed issue of material fact as to how much Steffi knew. Steffi herself admitted in her deposition that she knew about the ADHD, and Coach's testimony was that both Steffi and McGuire knew. We also have, if you look at
the evidence that she knew about the medication she was taking, that Ms. Coach was taking.
In their text messages, Ms. Coach let Ms. Steffi know that she had run out of her medication.
Okay. Did they have any knowledge that the medication did not work when she took the medication?
Oh, when taking the medication, it did work. The problem was that she no longer had access to it. She was relying on samples. She didn't yet have a prescription. Insurance
standard for disability that it needs. If you have medication that takes care of the condition, if medication can take care of the condition, my understanding of disability under the Act, which I believe this Act, the Kentucky Act, uses the pre-2008 definition of disability under the ADA.
Yes, and that is, I'm sorry.
Is that your understanding? Is the pre-2008 definition under the ADA for disability?
Yes, and that specifically impacts the first definition.
Okay. I thought under that definition of disability, if there is medication that will take care of your condition, it is not a disability.
Well, under MX Group Inc., that wasn't what they worked with, and that was before the 2008 amendments, so they were working with the same standards.
MX Group Inc.
Yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So if
counsel, when did the employer become aware that your client claimed to be disabled.
That's a disputed issue.
Having a condition or missing work from time to time doesn't necessarily put the employee on notice that you claim to be disabled. But when is it your position that either your client provided notice to the employer or the employer became aware mm-hmm. that she was disabled or claimed to be?
Well, Coach claims that she told Steffi and McGuire beforehand, but it's undisputed that once they received the letter from her medical care provider, Lemon, which was before her termination, they undoubtedly knew at that point. And now we go to the third definition of being regarded as disabled,
I'm not quite sure what point in time you're referencing there.
As far as
do you have a date or anything?
No, Ms. Coach doesn't have a specific date of when her conversations with Steffi regarding her impairments took place. But we do have the date of the letter, which was written the 17th and turned into Thames on the 18th. And Ms. Coach was fired on the 20th.
Well, allegedly, the decision was made to terminate your client before the letter was received by at least one day. What difference does that make in your analysis? Mm-hmm.
Well, Thames has provided three different dates, the 16th, the 17th, and the 20th. And officially, her termination happened the 20th. The wheels started before then. But for most cases that look at the wheels of termination being in process, that's before anything happened that had to do with the incident around the disability. In this case, we were in the midst of the incident that was caused by the disability. And it's a disputed issue of material fact, looking at the facts in the light best, you know, to Coach, that Steffi did already know at that point, and McGuire. And Steffi admitted herself that she already knew about the ADHD. So that kind of overlaps with how Thames would have a reason to know of Coach's disability. I think we've pretty thoroughly touched on that. Ross versus Campbell is another helpful case there. But if we want to go on to pretext, there are basically just a lot of inconsistencies in Thames' reasonings. And when there's a competing evidence, if the evidence is mixed, then summary judgment is not appropriate. So for instance, Thames states that Coach violated its policy, but she did follow a policy to excuse non-chargeable absences and for intermittent FMLA leave, which says that you only have to use the call-in procedures absent unusual circumstances, and Coach had an unusual circumstance. In addition, Thames had exit interview policy that it refused to do an exit interview with Coach. It tried to keep referencing things that happened outside of the 12-month look-back period. It ignored the fact that she had not done enough to be fired under their progressive discipline policy. There's just several things in the record that shows that it was an insufficient incidence to warrant her termination and to question as if the reasons provided did motivate the termination.
In terms of pretext, do you need to show, or do your client, is your client required to show that other similarly situated employees were treated better in relation to their terminations? And if so, is there any evidence in this case that you could point to in that regard?
We do not have information on other employees, but the pretext element of showing that a reasonable jury could find that the employer was being dishonest is an acceptable way, combined with the prima facie elements, to pass the summary judgment hurdle.
I'm not quite sure I understood what you just said there. Could you repeat that, please?
Yes. And to establish pretext, one needs to show that the employer's provided reasons have no basis in fact, that they did not actually motivate the termination, or that her provided reasons were insufficient to warrant termination.
All right.
As I understand it, the employer Thames is saying she was fired because of the absenteeism policy, that she had not called the right people before. Sorry, phone's going off here. Had not called the right people before she showed up, or she didn't show up, and this occurred numerous times, and therefore under the policy, that's the reason they fired her. What evidence is there that that's not a legitimate reason for their having fired her?
Because they ignored parts of their policy that didn't line up with what they wanted. They had a progressive disciplinary policy, and her absences didn't meet the level of termination. In addition, they were supposed to follow up and ask for additional medical support if they didn't like Lemon's letter. Lemon's letter even specifically said to follow up if they had any additional questions. They were supposed to even pay for another medical opinion if they wanted one. Regarding who she contacted, she was permitted to contact Steffi because she could contact either her supervisor, department head, or the head nurse in charge. And Steffi was both the department head and her supervisor. All right, since we are very short on time, I will go over to notice on FMLA really quick. And so under Walton, employees don't have to specifically cite the FMLA when they are requesting notice. Schrouder cites a specific circumstance with the example of if a voicemail box is full, meaning that that's an excuse for attempting notice and it not happening. That's kind of similar to what happened here with Coach attempting to text and attempting, or texting, but the reception didn't go through, and attempting to call, but the reception didn't go through, which is a communication problem on the employer's end and is an exception that Schrouder described.
Are you saying that your client did not provide notice of her desire to take FMLA leave, but she attempted to, and the reason she was not able to do so was because of the way the communication was set up by the employer? Is that the argument here?
May I answer your question? I see I'm out of time.
You can answer that if you would.
Yes. No, she did provide sufficient notice because of the exception. She attempted to provide notice. She sent a text. Her phone records also support that she attempted to call Steffi. The communication issue is an exceptional circumstance. And if you look at Tim's policies, even within their policies, there are exceptions. So that is a disputed issue of material fact, whether she meets all of those exceptions.
Anything else on that point?
No, Your Honor.
All right. Okay. Well, I see you're out of time, and you do have 3 minutes for rebuttal that you still have available. So we'll go to Mr. Wright at this point.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Wright.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. Joey Wright on behalf of Appalee Thames Healthcare Group, LLC. My opponent focuses on numerous factual discrepancies that they have kind of tried to highlight in an attempt to overlook or distract the court from the fact that there are no disputes of material fact, those facts that might affect the outcome of the lawsuit. And here, there are no disputes of material fact, and you haven't heard any today. I'll begin with, if we looked at the elements of the claims, I think this will become clear, but I'll begin, as my opponent began, with the KCRA disability claim. And Judge Bush, you're correct that the disability as defined in KCRA is the pre-ADAA definition. And if medication mitigates or manages the condition that is alleged to be the disability, that is not considered a substantial limit on a major life activity sufficient for a statutory disability under the KCRA. Here, the district court exhaustively reviewed the record and noted that Ms. Coach's medication did manage the condition. You mentioned or asked about whether or not Thames had any knowledge of the medication not working. Thames had no knowledge of, that Ms. Coach was taking medication for major depressive disorder, let alone that the medication wasn't working or at the time. And in this argument, Ms. Coach has consistently tried to bring up evidence of her ADHD, and in fact, noting that in 2016, she had a drug test that had Adderall, showed Adderall in her system. In 2017, there was no Adderall in her system, according to her drug test. But I want to be clear that the ADHD is not relevant to this analysis because it is not what was the disability in this, or the alleged disability in this circumstance. Here, as Ms. Coach notes in her brief many times, labeling this a major depressive episode, it is not the ADHD that is alleged to have kept Ms. Coach from notifying Thames inconsistent with its policies or appearing for work. So I think it's important that the court separate out here two conditions that Ms. Coach may indeed have, but legally speaking, and for these claims that we're focused on here, the ADHD is not relevant to what we're talking about today. Ms. Coach focuses on the second prong, regarded as, or a record of disability under the KCRA. The district court correctly found that she had no disability, and therefore she couldn't prove that she was regarded as having or had a record of having a statutory disability under the KCRA. That's a correct interpretation of the KCRA. The statute reads that there's a record of such an impairment, and that impairment is referring to subsection 1, which is an impairment that substantially limits a major life activity. And there's no evidence of that in the record. Ms. Coach has not presented personalized evidence of a disability as required by Kentucky law. Hallahan v. Courier Journal notes, and the same thing with Toyota Manufacturing from the Supreme Court, that the determination of whether a employee has a statutory disability under the ADA or under the KCRA is based on personalized evidence of how that condition may affect a major life activity of that individual. Here, Ms. Coach hasn't even pointed to what major life activity this condition affected. She has cited the National Institutes of Health for symptoms of ADHD and major depressive disorder. There's no evidence in the record that those symptoms are what Ms. Coach deals with, and she has not presented those facts throughout this litigation, despite having an opportunity to do so. So the KCRA claim, the disability claim, we think, you know, she can't meet the proof of a disability off the bat. As far as pretext, all that's required is that the employer have an honest belief in its decision for terminating her. And Smith v. Chrysler, you know, this court said it's just a reasonable basis for the termination. As Judge Bush, you pointed out or asked about previously, Thames did that. It cited its absentee policies as the basis for the termination. And there's no indication that there was any sort of motivation or otherwise or other facts that would indicate that it was not based on the absentee policies. Those policies
that claims did not follow consistently the policies. Do you have a response to that?
Sure. So first of all, let me kind of clarify what the policies state or require. The policies require that an employee call in 2 hours before the beginning of their shift to notify the on-call admin nurse or the department head, the staffing nurse. First of all, Steffi, while and Nicole Jesse, who is the assistant director of nursing, both testified that they are not responsible or proper contacts for scheduling purposes. There are different hallways in this facility. Each hallway has a unit head, and those nurses are the proper contacts for staffing. And then if an employee does not call within 2 hours before the shift, that is determined to be a no call, no show. And two of those, it is automatic termination. The first one is a final warning, and the second one is an automatic termination. Here, what happened was that Ms. Coach simply didn't comply with those policies. And there's unusual circumstances comes in when we're talking about intermittent FMLA leave. As Ms. Coach has alleged and argued in her brief before this court, that she was seeking intermittent FMLA leave. The policies clearly state that if an employee is seeking intermittent FMLA leave, they must comply with standard call-in procedures. This court in Sprouder, noted that that employers can terminate employees when they're seeking FMLA leave for not complying with attendance policies. Here, Ms. Coach simply didn't comply because she didn't agree with the policies. She knew that she wasn't supposed to contact Steffi, but she found that, to quote her words, asinine. And so she directly contacted Steffi, who is not the supervisor for this purpose, for staffing or scheduling purposes. And there are no unusual circumstances in the record because two reasons. One, the cell service issue that we're talking about with Steffi's cell phone problems, that's irrelevant because Ms. Coach shouldn't have been contacting Steffi in the first place. If Ms. Steffi testified that the facility has a 24/7 nurse available that you can contact and then get the number for the admin nurse or the proper contact to talk about scheduling. It's not as if this was a labyrinth of numbers to pick from or look at. All she had to do was contact the facility and talk to the proper person. And then on top of that, there's no unusual circumstances because Ms. Coach was physically able to comply with these policies and procedures. She, as the record shows in the district court pointed out, over the course of this relevant time period, she sent and received over 700 text messages and made nearly a dozen phone calls. The notion that she somehow was unable to do so is just simply not borne out by the record. Thames asserts, and the district court found that there is a legitimate reason for us to terminate her, and it is consistent with the policies as they're outlined. The discrepancies come in when you're looking at other leave that Coach wasn't seeking. Here, it's clear. If you don't call and you don't show up, two of those, automatic termination. And if you want intermittent FMLA leave, you've got to comply with those standard call-in procedures. And the DON and the ADON are not proper contacts for that. That's, we think, fairly straightforward here, and not an interference or retaliation or anything of the sort for Ms. Coach's alleged request for FMLA leave. If I could, too, I'd like to turn to Ms. Coach's request for FMLA leave or alleged request for FMLA leave and Thames's knowledge of any sort of disability or alleged serious health condition. To put it simply, Thames did not know of Ms. Coach's major depressive disorder at all. The first record of Thames finding out about it is August 18th, when Coach presents a letter in the facility, in the chair of Ms. Steffi. Before that, there's no record in Coach's file. There's no indication anywhere that Thames was aware that she had depression of any sort. And again, I want to emphasize that ADHD is not what we're talking about here. Her depression is the alleged serious health condition in this circumstance, and Thames just simply did not know about it. And Coach has not developed proof that Thames did know about it until the letter from Lemon that was given to them on August 18th. And then the interference claim, the district court correctly reviewed that FMLA interference claim and held that the Ms. Coach did not provide the facility with proper notice because on August 16th, she texted Steffi. There's some dispute on whether Steffi received that text, but even if the court, we assume that Steffi received it, it's not sufficient notice for FMLA leave. It simply says that I'm on a medication and it hit me hard and I can't get that medication. That it hit me hard on Sunday, which was 3 days prior to her sending that text message. It doesn't tell anything about what condition she's suffering. It doesn't say anything about when she's coming back. It doesn't say anything about whether she's able to do anything. It doesn't even request leave of any sort. And so the district court, again, found that even if the court looked at it and said she did receive that text message, again, putting all inferences in favor of the plaintiff by assuming that she received that text message, notice was still insufficient and her FMLA claim fails. And so her FMLA claims fail because there's no notice. She didn't comply with policies. She hasn't provided medical proof of an incapacity. And the employer, Thames, did not have knowledge before making the decision to terminate her on August 16th. So there's no retaliation.
Consider the serious health and condition of the FMLA to be the equivalent of the disability definition under the other act, or is it something different? I'm trying to figure out what is a serious health condition under the FMLA.
Sure. I think,
are you contending that she did not have a serious health condition?
We are, Your Honor, we are contending that she did not prove incapacity, a period of incapacity for three consecutive days, which is required under FMLA as part of the serious health condition. Various subsections as statutory claims go, but as part of her serious health condition, she alleges that she was receiving continuous treatment. In order to prove continuous treatment, she must show a period of incapacity, which means inability to attend school, work, do regular daily activities as part of that claim. So now to your question, they are very similar. the disability determination under the KCRA requires proof that she was experiencing substantial limitations on a major life activity. A major life activity is any sort of daily activity. It can be working, sleeping, reading, those things, which is overlaps very closely with the regular daily activity that incapacity requires under the FMLA. So we would argue, yes, Judge Bush, that there's lack of proof because there's no personalized proof that she was experiencing it, incapacity or a disability in the record, other than her saying she was experiencing it.
Is it not enough that you're just receiving treatment from a healthcare provider to have a serious health condition?
So I want to sort of, with a fine point here, say serious health condition, yes. And there's case law that, and I think Ms. Coach has cited that there's case law that says a major depressive disorder is a serious health condition. Our point is that under, and I could pull this, the actual statutory site, but under the FMLA regulations and statutes, she must, as in order to prove continuous treatment for the time that she missed work, she must show a period of incapacity for 3 consecutive days. That's the part that we are arguing she has not shown, is the period of incapacity, which is exists separately, but underneath a serious health condition.
All right, counsel, you've been out of time for a while, so thank you for your argument, and we will take rebuttal at this point.
Thank you. Regarding the policy and whether it was or was not followed, the Unemployment Commission found that Ms. Coach did not violate any policies. They said that she violated the no call, no show, and the Unemployment Commission did not agree with that. The way the no call, no show policy is worded is it is grouped with foreseeable absences, but there's a completely different section about absences that don't count against you. So if an employee is sick, if they bring in a doctor's note on their return date, then that's a non-chargeable absence and can't be held against them. And it says in that section that if you end up with too many non-chargeable absences, you should probably sit down and talk to your supervisor about what's best. That can't coexist with the no-call, no-show policy. Coach needed to bring in a doctor's note, and she did that. And regarding whether Steffi or Jesse have an opinion about whether they're the appropriate person to call, they are listed as people she can call, and that they are her supervisor and the head of the department. And for the intermittent policy that Mr. Wright cited, there is a qualifier of absent unusual circumstances in there. As far as showing personalized evidence of major depressive disorder with Ms. Coach, she and Lemon testified that she was mentally incapacitated, that she couldn't function, and that she didn't feel safe to work with patients, which is a huge deal and definitely shows that it was having a substantial impact on her work. Jumping over to FMLA leave, incapacity can also be shown through having a chronic condition such as depression, which Hansen versus Fincantieri of the Seventh Circuit talks about. And in that situation, technically you don't even need a doctor's note. So Coach actually went above and beyond in bringing in a doctor's note for the purpose of showing that she had a period of episodic incapacity for her chronic condition of depression.
Do you agree that ADHD is not at issue in this case?
I agree that it is not what spiked her major depressive episode.
So we should be only focusing on her depression as the underlying alleged disability or medical condition.
I do think it's a little more complicated than that, since Lemon was medicating her for both conditions, and both conditions were mentioned in the medical letter. And nurse practitioner Lemon is the only person with medical knowledge that has participated in this case so far. And we can't substitute our lay knowledge for medical knowledge. Thames had an opportunity to get their own medical person to look at the situation, and they chose not to. And I believe that's Swanson that talks about not being able to substitute lay opinions for medical opinions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your argument, and the case is submitted.